This is Thoughts on the Table by DisgracesOnTheMenu.com.
Hello, welcome back to Thoughts on the Table, the audio blog on food and food culture. Paolo here again, your host, and today a returning guest, Mindy King. Hi, Mindy.
Ciao, hello.
I'll call you Mindy, is that okay?
That's fabulous. I'm legally Melinda, but Mindy is what friends use.
Okay, I feel privileged to use that then. So, Mindy posted a guest article for the blog at first for me, and I was so happy about that because she talked about a very complex topic, and it helped me understand a little bit better what's behind, you know, what we call geographical indication. So all those symbols that we see have appeared on products, we see them in Italy, but we actually see them all over Europe, and they've started to appear in other countries too. So Mindy, in this article, which was actually published exactly a month ago, breaks it down very well in detail. So I put a link in the podcast notes. But today in this podcast, I asked Melinda to break down the article a little bit because it's a long article and we want to kind of get to the core of the issue here, which is an issue maybe of authenticity, which is something that I talk a lot about in my podcast and blog. And geographical indication, I think, touches on that. Is that right, Melinda?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's important to discuss what and why geographical indications are being used, but to also make sure that people understand that we're not talking about organic or nutritional facts or, you know, necessarily free trade agreements or kosher. So that this is really a different level of certification that we're not always used to in the grocery store, in the marketplace, but it has cultural, social, political, economic, and historical meanings.
Right. And it's about place, if we want to jump ahead. Mm-hmm. This is really about place. Is that right?
Place and people who are producing it, mm-hmm. and how they've been doing it traditionally.
Right. So, yes. And that's not something simple to break down, because really, as you say, you know, Italy is really this crossroad of cultures. There's a lot that happened there. And so what we see now is the result of that, but also it's constantly evolving. So, you know, traditions change. And, what are we trying to certify? Really trying to certify, put a label on something. But is this something, you know, a moving target?
Absolutely. That's a wonderful point, is when you really break it down, who belongs where and what belongs where. I mean, even I was talking with some people today at the winery where I work. They said, well, where do these grapes come from? And I would just explain to them that they are indigenous to Italy, but that doesn't mean that they're from Italy originally. And if you think about this in terms of what's on the table for an Italian meal, it's really the breadbasket of the Mediterranean, of the world. Tomatoes aren't from Italy, but they are a basis for so much of Italian food. So if you want to certify something as Italian, you need to look at not only who's making it, but where it comes from. And I'm talking about on a molecular microorganism level. So,
yeah. So it gets really complicated. But in your article, you say something. I wrote down a few quotes from your post. Even though it's a moving target, what people eat for most of human history depends on where people live. And even right now, even though Italy is a crossroad, etc., it's still true that what you eat depends on where you live.
Absolutely. You know, that's called the geography of food. And that's for reasons depending on natural resources, climate, altitude, the community of people, even, obviously the proximity to water and vegetation, but the habits of the people who live there and what they use to cook and the oil that they have and the fats that they have and the seasons and how they respect the seasons. So what is there, period. So
right. It's true.
So interesting.
Place does matter. And so this is why we have geographical indication certification. So can you state it with your own words, which are the proper ones, what is geographical indication officially?
Oh boy, okay. It's based on authenticity, it's based on protection, and it's also based on terroir, as they called it in France in the beginning, what we know as terra or place. I use the word terroir very sparsely, almost never, because we don't want to ever compare something to another country in Italy. We want to use the word terra. But the entire geographical indication system is based on the French model of appellation.
Mm-hmm.
We can use that as an example, and Italy did copy some of it, but now it does exist in all of Europe. So geographical indication is a base. It's the way we legally recognize quality of place, meaning it tastes like it tastes because it's from this place.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a physical symbol on a product that's representing the philosophical and political circumstances.
Right.
However, it doesn't mean that there are official foods and that, like, we're talking about lasagna or tiramisu,
right,
or orecchiette. We're just really talking about certain food products are trademarked as Italian, can't be impersonated or misrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really at the core of it, not just to protect traditions, but also to protect environment and land and ways of life and rural development. And that's one of the core issues of the European program,
mm-hmm,
is they constantly talk about rural development. And this is really the post-war model of taking care of people who are growing the economy as best they can based on what they have been doing for hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a protective, certification.
Yeah, it is a symbol on a food that says, this was made here in this way. We protect the name of it. It would be similar to a copyright in North America, except it's nationally recognized as well as privately recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really connecting value between the food and the territory. And then in the market, guaranteeing the quality for which the consumer will pay a higher price.
Right.
So
we'll go back to that, because the higher price may have an impact. But to finish up on the description of what geographical indication is, for European Union, there are currently three schemes for geographic preservation, which are three different levels, if you want, of protection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to just call them out because they are in the article. So the protected designation of origin, as PDO in English, but it gets translated, so it becomes a different acronym in different countries, which is the red one, which means that the entire product must be traditionally and entirely manufactured within that specific region. And then there is the protected geographical indication, blue symbol, which is similar, but must be at least partially manufactured there, still traditionally. And then there is the TSG, so Traditional Specialties Guarantee, which means that the food must be of specific character, and either the raw materials, the production method, or the processing must be done in that exact area. So again, this is location.
Yeah, absolutely. And Traditional Specialties Guaranteed is the more recent of those additions, obviously. Like, for example, really what we're talking about at this point, it has not been developed, but it is something that is very important on another level. For example, Neapolitan pizza.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that is tied to the city of Naples. It cannot be, done anywhere else and called Neapolitan pizza. And it is something that is absolutely recognized as the tie with the city and the pride. And this is something that's a little more controversial as they're trying to introduce this category. But when I think of the first two, PDO, PGI, it's just now really starting to be talked about more commonly. And you'll hear and you'll see people talking in advertisements or in the marketplaces. They don't say PDO, they say DOP, D-O-P. And in a menu in a restaurant, you can see this pizza made with this cheese or this dish with this item, DOP, DOP.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, it's a selling point now, but it's really a sense of, well, this is a special item. We're only doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it becomes prestige as well. And a way to, elevate. Yes, which is good. I like that because it's giving value to this particular quality that the product has. Because, you know, we're really talking about quality. The fact that it has reached this status, you know, it's indicative of the fact that it has certain properties that can be hardly recreated elsewhere.
Yeah, and that's really foundational for the entire system is... You can't take a cheese from a certain city in Italy and then go make it in Germany and call it the same cheese name and say, what's the difference?
Yeah.
You can't do that. You're breaking that protection.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, the European Union has introduced these symbols that go back to several years ago. I think we're talking about the initially in the 90s. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, so, and they redo it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They reorganize them so much that you can't even keep track of it. And now they're actually reorganizing the Lisbon-Geneva Agreement, which is another easier way to protect things. And so there's always things being added to the list and further protections being made.
Right. And I've asked you, and I'm just going to read your answer because it's just lots of numbers. So... there are currently 3,000 registered products within the EU, and you mentioned that Germany has 9 beers, Sweden has a cheese. This is just you cherry-picking some examples. Sweden also has some meat and some beans. Spain has 15 breads and pastries. Croatia, 6 meats and sausages, and so forth, right? Every country has gotten in there. To me, this is a good first step, because really the immense value, even just the documenting all of this, is intangible to me.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's important to just say that some of the countries that are newer, like Slovenia, they're very excited to participate in this program of protection because what they have to offer is very special to them. And they're looking at this as a way to be recognized. So, you know, recently... the last addition to the list was in April of this year, and it was Bulgarian honey.
Mm-hmm, right.
And if you think about it culturally, all of the politics that are going on in our world, if you can stop and just say, we're really proud of our honey, that is a very good feeling.
It's good news, finally, yes. We're worrying about the right things, finally.
Yeah.
This is good.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So yes, I see all of these as a big positive. But as we mentioned earlier, there may be also some, let's call it negatives. There are costs associated with certification. You know, you have to, as a producer, you have to get certified, which requires, you know, inspections, and maybe you need to adjust a little bit your methods. And, you know, this cost. And then obviously you have to get this cost back by increasing the price. So
yes, it is very expensive, not only to actually put your product out for application, but then when it's accepted, you have to follow the rules. You need to have kind of a constitution that's overseeing the product and the processes. You have to make a giant writing that describes every single step. All the raw materials, all the resources, all the labor, the timing, all of these things. You need to also have an overseeing board called a consortium.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who oversee all the producers in the region and everybody follows the rules. But more than that, you pay for these things. And then you have to have regular up checks. You have to, you know, keep in current with all the standards. And then there's the issue of marketing. Because once you're lucky to get the certification, and the consortium is supposed to help with promotion and marketing, but everybody pays those costs. Mm-hmm. For example, Parmigiano Reggiano is the best known GI product in Italy, maybe a few others, Prosciutto di Parma, etc., but they are known the world over, and they have such a magnificent budget And what they do is they'll go to conventions in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. They'll go to food shows in Tokyo. They promote products all over the world. They're the official food of the International Space Station.
Right.
And if you think about it, where does that money come from? These self-promoting things have to be paid for. Mm-hmm. And not all the members of this group get compensation. Not mm-hmm. everyone is making a ton of money. These are small family farms.
Yes.
But all the money is controlled by the consortium.
Right.
The difficult part of food production and farming is always bureaucracy.
Yes. So, yeah, so there are producers who choose not to be part of this scheme. Sometimes I think, you know, in my experience, these are people who maybe decide to only have a small market. Mm-hmm. If you're only selling in your area and you've built a reputation for yourself, so you have a brand that is recognized there, you know, internally you make it like you've always made it. And so, yeah, it is still traditional and everything really about that. But, you know, you don't have those costs. You don't have those inspections. You just make sure you follow your own rules. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's something that is extremely important with Italian food. Mm-hmm. If you have been going to the same butcher your whole life, mm-hmm. why would you go to the grocery store to get a food that has a certain symbol on it when you know where quality? You know about his children. You know where he lives. You know where the pigs come from. And there are certain rules that allow you to buy from what they call the farm gate with no certifications necessary. But if you choose to put that food into the bigger market, you have to do it. You have to pay a lot of money.
Right. Yeah, so I think it's perfectly valid that some producers will choose not to be. But I'm sure that there's people who are damaged by this because really they could benefit from it, but they would also need to, you know, invest a lot and it's a risk, et cetera. So yes, this is something that is, I suppose, constantly being debated. Definitely a complex issue. You've wondered a lot how I feel as an Italian, you know, when I see a logo or when I see that the logo is not there, when it's missing. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that. But really, we are now transitioning into the second part of this podcast where you've prepared some questions for me. And I'm very happy that you have. But I'm just going to talk about my personal opinion, which is far different than what we've been doing so far, which is stating what the law is and the official rules are.
Well, I feel this is the utmost important thing to do because there are so many surveys happening and so many marketing ventures always about what the European consumer is buying. But I have yet to really hear anything about asking a real Italian, well, what do you think? What do you feel? So it's nice not to have a statistic when we have an expert. And thank you for your honest answers. I'd like to go ahead and ask.
Yeah.
To start, I just would like to know, when did you first start to pay attention and see these Italian GI labels?
Yeah, so about that, I think I've seen them pop up very slowly. So I lived in Italy until about year 2000. So these were introduced in the 90s. So I did see them pop up. But then really I moved to Canada. And now I have to say, when I go back, I get to see more and more the use of these symbols, even on restaurants menus, like you were saying. So I think it's really exploded in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And it was really subtle before then. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Interesting.
But I did know about, for instance, wine certification. That has always been there. So I knew about DOC, DOC, and DOCG. But the rest is rather new to me.
Well, most people know about one or the other. They know about the food certifications and not the wine, or they know about the wine and are completely surprised that there's a food organization. So I think most of the time, anyone that I talk to who is an Italian doesn't understand how complicated it is.
Oh, yeah,
how
for sure.
Much work has been done. They just talk about, you know, lentils or lemons. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the list, it's astonishing the amount of really specific foods and specific details and how many kinds of olive oils there are and how many kinds of lemons there are in it. Mm-hmm. It's really complicated.
Right, right. Absolutely. Well, I think for me, the wine was something that maybe my parents have exposed me to. Like, say, yeah, we're getting this one. This one is good. It's a DOC. You know, so maybe that's why. For me, it was always associated to some kind of prestige. So it was like one step up. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people in the wine world who are consumers or who are kind of experienced experts tend to assume that a DOC or a DOCG is automatically better. But you have to really look at the flip side of saying that's tradition and that's production based on climate and region and area. However, there's a lot of room for creativity. Mm-hmm. And so not saying it's right or wrong, but if you think about the Super Tuscan wines that came out in the 90s, those were incredibly popular and extremely expensive and very well-made wines. Mm-hmm. The only difference was they didn't want to follow the regulations to the T.
Right.
And they wanted to do their own thing. Mm-hmm. So it really comes down to if you would like to buy something that you have an expectation for, or if you would really like to see what's happening in innovation as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Very good point.
Or just really well-made wines, because some of the best wines are just table wines and they don't expect anything spectacular or special, and they're not extraordinarily expensive. They're good wines to go with food.
Right. Exactly. Should we continue with more questions then?
Please. Here's a little more of a creative question for you, but Paolo, do you think anything is missing from the current GI protection scheme? And what would you personally like to see? And what should we be looking at?
Okay, so I did think about this a little bit because it wasn't easy. It's a difficult question, a very good one. I think, you know, it's probably way beyond the scope of GI, but having lived in Vancouver, I really wish there was something to prevent bad imitations. Like, I wish I could, you know, report somebody for using Italian or from Italy, when really, if you look at it, there's really nothing from Italy in it. It's just the words.
I think that you would shut down quite a few restaurants, my friend.
Probably. But anyway, the second part of my answer is about something that I think might be missing. I come from being in the United Kingdom now, in England. So we do get some fresh products from Italy. For instance, Gorgonzola Dolce, which is the freshest of the Gorgonzola, which is supposed to be creamy, you know, and quite delicate. And by the time it gets here, it's not as creamy anymore. So it's still labeled as Gorgonzola Dolce. It has a GI symbol, as Gorgonzola does. But, you know, I wish there was something in the GI certification that would say how the product should be maybe distributed, what kind of conditions, and maybe even just best before dates. I don't know if there's anything about it.
No, that is a fascinating, absolutely fascinating point of view, because not only are you right, and that has to deal with food tracing and tracking and quality all the way across, but the consortio has always a written constitution, I said, of how the things are processed and produced, down to the kind of basket you can collect grapes in, to what kind of packaging, what kind of plastic is used, what labeling is used. But once it leaves, it's totally out of their hands, and it's still got the name on it. Mm-hmm. So how do you oversee that quality all the way until it's at home for the consumer, especially when you're exporting it? It leaves a lot of room, not only for lowering of quality, but also for people to come in and manipulate and take advantage.
Right.
An excellent point.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't think it was so special, but thinking about it, there's really a lot about that, because really, I don't think my English friends can never know what Dolce means. So we're really distorting the product a lot.
That's true, though. Very true. Well, then that leads to my next question, which is, I'm interested to know what your priorities are when you're buying and using Italian ingredients. And also then, I guess, what are the labels or what are the priorities that are most important to you?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, again, I think this is, when I answer this question, I'm thinking a specific example. So for certain things, it's not really that I have religiously have to follow some rules. If it's not Italian, I'm not going to buy it. But I've really learned from experience to stay away, for instance, from dried pasta that is not from Italy. I think, you know, my experience is just absolutely not the same. Durum, even though some... Yes. And maybe somebody can prove me wrong, I'll be happy. But so far, you know, I will just try to find Italian pasta. Also because it's always available, right? It has a long shelf life. So if you know, if you go to a specialty store, you definitely find it. I think for fresh pasta instead, I'm okay to buy local. Also because I think I can see it with my eyes if it's going to be good or not. There's something about the color and the thickness. And so I trust that more. And then, you know, I'll try it and I like some brands. I don't like others. But yeah, I think in some cases I go Italian just to be safe. And because unfortunately I've learned that it's not otherwise what I think it should be.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's move on to the next question.
And next question is one I'm very, very interested in. I'd like to know, from your point of view, what are the biggest changes in Italian food culture that you've experienced or felt in your lifetime?
Yes, another really good question. So I'm going to answer two things that I've noticed changed in my lifetime. So the one thing is cooking shows on TV. So growing up, yes, we've always had the recipes and something on TV, but now it's become really big and Italy joined in as well. Some of these shows come from North America, I know, but Italy totally embraced that. We talk about food, we show it on TV all the time. And then another thing that has changed, of course, is social media, especially things like Instagram. Mm. So people, you know, have been posting their own things. They've been posting what they eat in restaurants. They've been, you know, tagging all those things. So I think this is huge. And, you know, my mother gets her recipes from TV now. So it's not my grandma's recipes anymore. So this obviously it's good, but also maybe bad. I don't know. I think it's always good. But in a way, it's changed. It's changed a lot how people, you know, decide what to cook.
Right. Yeah, and especially with our scheduling and time changes today, I think we're always talking about how busy we are, and yet it's a choice. We don't always have the opportunity to do what we would like to do and to really follow the traditions by the book. But if you take the tradition and you build upon it with what you have as a resource, I think that that's a really interesting place where Italian culture has landed right now.
That's right. That's right. And I think this ties to your next question. Is that right?
Exactly. In your experience and opinion, Paolo, what are the roles of tradition and creativity in regards to Italian food?
Yes. So about this one, if you listen to this podcast, you probably heard me talk about this before. So I'm trying not to repeat myself too much, but really, I think that Italians are creative. But for them, creativity has to be rooted into tradition. So tradition means a lot of constraints. There are things that you don't do and you don't ever think about doing. Another thing that I say a lot is that, you know, I really believe that if you want to break the rules, you first need to know what the rules are. So really, do you have to try making risotto traditionally? Once or twice, I would say at least 10 times. And then, you know, make your risotto maybe with strawberries. Go ahead. You know, I'll try it. Maybe good. I don't know.
Right. Well, I want to ask you a second part of that question.
Yeah.
What was your experience growing up with Artusi in your home?
Oh, Artusi. Actually, I discovered him quite recently. So I think, you know, if you look at historic cookbooks, they're very fascinating. It's something that, it's a completely different world. Marcella Zantu, I discovered her recently. These were huge in certain circles, but didn't really enter my family. We had the Silver Spoon. You'd probably be familiar with that.
You have to.
Yes.
You have to.
Yes, because it has a lot of traditional recipes on it, and pretty much they created a catalog of staples, but thousands of them. So it's really it's really an encyclopedia of Italian food.
Mm. Well, moving forward a little bit more, so we've already come to the understanding that Italy is quite famous for bureaucracy. I would like to know from your point of view. Does that get in the way of honest and good food?
Probably, because, we've said that anything that has to do with certification, it requires paperwork and, a few steps, a process. So yes, Italians will find ways to turn that into something even more complicated than it needs to be, because we tend to do that. But
Italians love to have things be official.
Yeah.
Like, a big stamp to put on something, or a big organization and an official title.
Yes.
So it can be, I think, on both sides, it can be very good, as well as this can delay things for 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it may pile up somewhere. So yeah, it's possible. I hope not, but yeah, I'm sure it happens.
All right, so my last question, I think, is maybe the most important. I'd like for you to give an example of a geographically specific meal from your home region in Lombardia.
Okay, yes. So I do have one that I like to talk about. It's the dish called pizzoccheri, which I'm sure you know it. It's something that is indigenous of Valtellina, which is a small valley up north of Lombardy, so near Switzerland, and it's on the mountain. And so this dish is comprised of these noodles, which are made of buckwheat flour mixed with wheat flour. And they are short tagliatelle. So tagliatelle, they've been cut in like stripes of 5 or 6 centimeters, a couple of inches. And so because of the buckwheat flour, they have this very nutty, hearty flavor, delicious, a little bit rough, a little bit, on the palate, strong texture. And they are cooked together. It's a one-pot dish. They're cooked together with potatoes and cabbage, traditionally. You can also use spinach, or there are other variations. So this dish is then layered in the plate, that's the way I know it, with some cheese. And the cheese to be used is traditionally Valtellina Casera, which is also indigenous of the same valley, and also with plenty of butter and parmigiano. So this dish makes me drool because it's amazing. It's very hearty. Yeah, it's very comfort food. And it's just an extremely satisfying meal to have.
So what you're also reminding us is that the geographical indication status is very much used for tourism.
Mm-hmm,
it is a tremendous benefit for tourism, because right now you're really encouraging me and everyone else to just go immediately
go there
to eat this. It's part of so many tourism plans at this time, whether it's for wine roads or for cheese or for balsamic vinegar. Come here, because we are an official GI food. And I think when you talk about this dish, it's the culmination of many aspects of this place, not just the noodle.
Yes.
But it really is the kitchen representing the entire way of life there.
Absolutely. I must admit, I've never been in Valtellina myself, but I grew up in Lombardy, which is another thing, So the version that I know is what my mother makes. It's popular enough in the region that people make them. You can buy the noodles as dry pasta in the supermarkets of Northern Italy, for sure in Lombardy, maybe also in other regions. And when I go to
Veneto as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when I go there, I purchase extras to bring to England now, because that's one of those things that I don't find here. And then one time I also bought some Valtellina Casera in my hometown, which is in the province of Milan. So quite a ways away from Valtellina, but you can find Valtellina Casera easily there. And so I think actually it was now that I'm in England, for the first time I cooked the dish in the way it's supposed to, only using ingredients from the valley. So that happened a few months ago. Yeah, so something
magnificent.
Yeah, super happy.
I have one last question for you.
Oh yeah,
and I'm very interested to know, now that you are in England, how aware have you been of British and UK GI foods?
Almost not aware.
No.
No, I haven't seen much at all in the way of British GI foods.
Well, of course, they probably don't promote them quite as much as they would in Italy, but UK does have 65 items. So I encourage you to just keep your eyes open. And I was talking with some people from Scotland just yesterday, and they were telling me not just about this particular whiskey, but they were talking about another one of the items that is on this list. And they were so excited over it. And they said, you know, we don't have Italian foods and we don't have Italian cultures and we're not obsessed with our foods like you people are.
Yeah.
However, we think we could compete pretty well. And
I'm sure
I was laughing so much about this because now can the European Union foods become competitive items?
Yep, for sure.
Are we going to have Olympics with our food?
Well, we tend to compete a lot on these things. So at least, you know, in words. But yeah, no, I think I'll make a point to go out and find these products.
Okay.
I think I'm just not paying attention. That's the thing. So I buy a lot of produce from here, which I love. And then when it comes to packaged products, I can tend to gravitate towards Italian because more now. I have more now that I can go to in Vancouver. We couldn't quite do that. So, yes, it's probably what's happening. But I'll pay more attention. I'll keep my eyes open.
Okay.
Mindy, it's been fantastic talking with you. We're out of time for this episode. I hope that people listening have enjoyed it as much as I'm sure we did making it. And best of luck with everything. And enjoy the weather there. It seems to be still pretty cold down where you are.
Well, no, I work on the volcano. So it was snowing there, but it's quite sunny back where I live.
Okay, so
it's
you're
only
down now.
30 degrees difference in 1 hour.
Yeah, we should say maybe people don't know you're based in Sicily right now.
Right now, yeah. I live between Veneto and Sicily, and right now I am working through my... I work in a winery on Etna, so we do very special work here, and then I drive home and I live next to the beach.
Oh, fantastic. So we'll also be posting your handles. You now have an Instagram and a website as well.
Yeah.
So we will be adding all of that to the writing for this podcast.
Yes, and you know, I'm a photographer, and basically I just try and document the Italian agriculture and food production system, the things that we don't ever think about or get to see one-on-one. It's not a beautiful Instagram filled with luscious photos of people drinking wine. It's really raw materials and just moments of Italian life.
Yes, it's a very true one. It's a rare. It's
thank
not
you.
Just pretty pictures. It's a real life. So thanks so much for doing that.
Well, thank you, Paolo. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Have a good night. Bye-bye. Take care.